21 years ago, the city, the province, and the Fed signed the Vancouver Agreement that ultimately became the Four Pillars Strategy. It was designed as a shared vision of creating a healthy, safe, and sustainable downtown Eastside. A long list of objectives were designed to improve health and access to emergency and crisis interventions, build better access to hospital care, reduce preventable deaths, reduce overall costs to the economy related to substance misuse, reduce crime, make the downtown Eastside safe, and promote economic links between it and the city as a whole. The list of missed objectives is long. According to Dr. Julian Summers, a SFU addictions, mental health, and homelessness expert, he says if we want to bring about real change, you can't do it the way that we're doing it now. To affect real change, he says, we have to come to understand the root causes of addiction and the conditions that promote people to make positive change. Under the current leadership, he says, we have been backed into a corner where the civic duty of every British Columbian now includes knowing how to administer Narcan. We invited Dr. Julian Summers to join us for a conversation that matters about how we can develop a path to recovery from homelessness and addiction, a path he maintains is attainable for everyone, but not by the current methods. Julian, thank you for joining me on this episode of Conversations That Matter. You know, a couple of years ago, I was asked by a couple of different members of police department to look at what was going on in the city of Vancouver, that we seem to be seeing this long, slow deterioration, especially around issues of homelessness. How did we get to this situation? Because weren't we supposed to have tried to address this going back 14, 15 years ago?
Well, if you're referring to perhaps the first Robertson mayoral campaign, or is that sort of era?
Yeah, in around there, we had the at home program, and the idea was that we were going to try and put people in homes to get them off the street and to give them a considerable amount of freedom in choosing what it was that was going to help them move off the street and move into a home where they could better manage their circumstances.
Well, so we have had the opportunity to attempt that very approach, Stu, and in fact, a fairly thoroughgoing attempt at that. But we have absolutely not managed yet to make that a normal part of our response. As a consequence, we persistently have failed in getting around to really and meaningfully mounting responses that do address their needs.
So why do we fail? What is it that we're not doing that can give us more success? Because we most definitely are pouring an awful lot of money and attention into addressing these issues, and yet it seems to be getting worse and worse and worse.
I think it's the case that wealth inequality, the challenge of finding housing, the ups and downs of employment in our province have created greater numbers of people experiencing homelessness, and our large players, BC Housing, provincial government, municipal governments, are scrambling to support the 80% or so who are homeless principally because of economic reasons, and in many respects have been doing a serviceable job. However, I know I'm coming back to your question in a way, right, but wanting to put it in some context, because it is not as though we collectively have been doing nothing. The challenges of responding to people with those additional challenges I referred to really goes back to the 1970s and 80s, and the downsizing or the shift away from institutional responses to those that the slogan, if those that remember, was closer to home. Yep. And we've yet to make good on that. We've learned in the interim how best to make good on that commitment. And I hope now is the time when people are so aware of the need to build back better, that we avail ourselves of that evidence and implement services accordingly.
This brings up a question of, like, how can we help people transition off the street into independent living? Is it a graduated process through detox and a variety of other transition processes? Or do we need to also, or alternatively, or complementary in a complementary way, say, well, we're going to give you the power to make some of those choices because ultimately this is in your hands?
So in a nutshell, the latter option appears to be the most effective. And that I'm generalizing, but it amounts to beginning with the end in sight. If our goal, and so now keep in mind, if we're trying to develop sort of a profile of what sort of people are we describing? We've done a great deal of work with people who are characterized by service providing agencies as the hardest to house. In many cases, people who have been barred from accessing services due to the challenges that they present. And when we interview people who meet these criteria of, on average, 10 years homeless, struggling with very serious psychological symptoms alongside addictions, they have an average of about 10 criminal sentences. And they've worked in the past. About 60% have worked continuously for a year in the past. Over 90% would like to resume paid work. And when we look around the world at what's possible in terms of recovery, the figures from other countries, well, countries outside of North America, illustrate that when normal practice involves supporting people, say, diagnosed with schizophrenia, to live their entire lives in community settings, in their own homes, the opportunities for recovery, meaning people who once met criteria for schizophrenia now no longer meet criteria, are much, much greater than if we house them in settings like, as you were referring to earlier, institutional settings or even quasi-institutional settings, group homes in communities, where the expectations placed on them are simply lesser. The day-to-day challenges that they engage in are quite different. More is done for them or to them. So we see that the opportunity for people to actually recover is much greater than we thought it was. And I haven't mentioned this yet, but the average age of the people that we've worked with is in the mid-30s. So they have a lot of life ahead of them. And what we've found is the most useful way to engage them in their own recovery is wherever possible to support their agency and choices. They would like to become neighbors. They would like to establish themselves as citizens in so-called normal neighborhoods. Now, this is not every single person, but there is international research on the preferences of people who are currently homeless and struggling with mental illness. And about 90% have a strong preference for independent market housing. We no longer need to anticipate providing lifelong care to people who are struggling at a given point with serious mental illnesses and addictions. We need to expect that many will recover to a point where competitive employment and a substantial step down in the services that they require is likely, and then give them that opportunity. That's really our what we've learned over these ensuing decades is our long-term best play, and it happens to accord with what people say they want.
Right, and so they take more responsibility by doing so, and we're, I guess, less intrusive in their lives, telling them, well, you have to do this to get that reward, and in doing so, do we then trap them in a system that makes it very difficult for them to move beyond the place that they find themselves in life?
Yeah, that is the case. Importantly, recalling where we started this particular exchange was around the intractable challenges related to homelessness. for many people struggling with the kinds of things that we're discussing, there aren't even options to get started. But where we do offer people places, there is very limited capacity to move forward and to more advanced types of interactions as community members and returning to support to return to competitive employment and that sort of thing. So people have told us very regularly, even when they have the good fortune to be in some of our better supported housing units in the Lower Mainland especially, they struggle mightily with boredom and a lack of support to become further engaged in their communities, even through employment and volunteering. So there's a huge amount of opportunity here to not only help people, but offset some of the societal and personal costs that are a consequence of our neglect.
Yet many of us would say, but we're not neglecting them. We're doing all these things. We're trying to help people, you know, manage their way through their addictions and so on. And yet in doing so, we in many ways seem to be handcuffing them to the very situation that they're in. You know, a couple of years ago, I had a fellow on who was on the hydromorphone program here. And he said the problem with it is that he had to keep going back multiple times a day. And as a result, he couldn't work. And he wanted to work, and the very program that was designed to help him was actually impeding his own personal progress. And, like, I mean, these are his words.
Yeah, that's unfortunately that's a fairly common observation, not only in association with the hydromorphone program, which is a much more it's an uncommon form of opiate agonist therapy, let's say, in comparison to methadone. But the same is true for methadone. People following our current procedures, in the main, must go and access methadone each day, and it amounts to the same thing for some individuals. They have to choose between a day of work or a day on methadone. An interesting result was published last year looking at the Ontario medical program, methadone program, pardon me. And they found, they reported straightforwardly what I found to be a quite shocking a result, which was that for every year on methadone, there was a 7% increase in the likelihood that women recipients would be charged with a criminal offense. And I think this is related to your observation about employment, that rather than being, as it was when it was introduced, methadone was meant to be an inducement into a process of recovery that included returning to work and re-engaging with family and community. And over time, it's been separated from those kinds of psychosocial supports and working intensively with people on an individual basis, to the point where now, instead of increasing or seeing employment as a sign of that the methadone program has been successful, now the methadone program is judged for being successful by retaining people day over day, and as a consequence, increasing their involvement with crime to support themselves.
It's remarkable, isn't it? So if we take a look across the Atlantic to Portugal, is that an example that we can say, look at what happens when we have this coordinated approach that works in harmony with the needs of the individual, rather than saying, here's a block program and this is the way that you're going to, that it's going to be carried out?
I think there is quite a bit that we can learn from Portugal and apply in British Columbia. There's a lot has been published, and I'll also try to stay true to the words of my colleague Nuno Capaz, who has been responsible for the dissuasion commissions in Portugal since their inception, and integrating the information that my understanding, including Nuno's description, the role of decriminalization, or in particular, the transition to making possession of drugs an administrative offense, was one of the key components for them, because it enabled police to detain an individual who, by their estimation, had a personal problem associated with drug use, and bring them to a place that was extrajudicial and really designed to help solve personal problems. So a key part of the administrative offense, the change to that in law, was in fact, that's the easy part. The harder part is mounting what they described as, or what they called, dissuasion commissions, and all of the resources that the dissuasion commissions were able to refer people to. So in real time, to drug treatment, to housing, to employment specialists. And one of the concerns that I have right now in Canada, there's quite a bit more discussion about altering our legal standards, which is important. But I believe that the effectiveness that we've seen in Portugal and elsewhere is that those changes can have effect when they're paired with opportunities for individuals to change. If we don't see them as intrinsically related, I think we run the risk of relaxing controls over what remains an illicit market and making more and more people vulnerable to it.
Can we do it here? Is it possible? Do we have any experience that suggests that it is possible?
it's definitely possible. It's not only is it possible, I think there is, as I've been inquiring, there's really pent up will to make it so. We have the complement of knowledgeable service providers who are often not in positions to provide a certain level of care for people because of resources, not because of lack of knowledge and understanding. We have information systems in BC that are really unrivaled in the world. We don't currently track when someone is homeless, but if we were to add that as a component, we would be able to identify, using other sources of information that we have, people who are both homeless and who've been repeatedly hospitalized in association with mental illness, who've been struggling with employment for a number of years, who've been receiving shelter assistance for a number of years, who've been charged with crimes associated with survival, and then measure, using those same information sources, measure our progress in addressing those challenges. So there's no question in my mind that we can do it, and that there's a strong will to do so.
So when somebody winds up in a situation of this perpetual cycle where they're homeless or they're living on the edge for a long period of time, it's not unusual for them to give up hope. I have to tell you just a story. I was on a ride along with the Vancouver police a few years ago, and we wound up going to attend to a call, a man who was on record as saying that he wanted to die by death by cop. He was going to incite an incident so that the police would kill him. Here are these two police officers. They attend to the call. They talk him down. And one of the police officers, with great compassion, said, "You know, why? Like, why do you want this outcome? Like, you're on record as saying this. How come?" This poor fellow, you know, he's in his mid-30s, and like it really rocked me, and it still upsets me today. Shook his head and said, "I got no hope." And have we created a situation where, you know, we're trying to help people, but we're not giving them the opportunity to see a future that's beyond where they're at?
Well, yes. Keeping in mind that I bring to this the perspective of a psychologist, and I see that dynamic applying far more broadly, I mean, to far more people over time. So I do believe that those forces are affecting most everyone in the population. And we have to get our heads around, I think, two things. One is addressing, using the evidence that we have now to address people who are currently in crisis. That has not only effects on those individuals, but effects on the effectiveness of other resources that are put in place to assist people who don't necessarily have the most severe needs. But these are reactive. We also have to get our heads around what it means to be proactive so that we prevent the continuing growth in demand for this type of assistance.
So is it going to take political courage to make this happen, to make this shift?
I believe that's currently the bottleneck. I believe that political courage is the key setting, because, or political decision making.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Because it's going to take politicians who are going to have to say some things that may not sound as compassionate as the messages that we have today, but in the long run may produce a greater or a better outcome.
I happen to think that the message is more compassionate. I think the challenge to elected officials is to listen to and provide support to service providers who are not currently the mainstream powers,
right,
in our province. BC Housing is a critical partner in addressing the needs I'm describing, but they do not, as an agency, have the expertise to mount the service. Health authorities and medical expertise is also an essential contributor, but similarly, they don't have the expertise or the ethos to provide comprehensive recovery-oriented services that includes helping people to find work, to become members of communities, and to address their psychological well-being. So we don't need to spend more, but we need the courage to spend differently.
Right. Well, I like you, remain hopeful that we can find that path forward. Thank you very much for having this conversation with me. I really appreciate you taking the time to share your insights.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.